Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on the show, and what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Today is the second installment in our series, School Stories. Every Tuesday for the month of September, we are focusing on issues related to Vermont's elementary, middle, and high schools. Last week, we discussed schools consolidation and closures. This week, behavioral issues in the classroom. The idea for this show came from one of our guests, Annie O'Shaughnessy. This past spring, she emailed us after listening to our interview with Vermont's interim education secretary, Zoe Saunders. Annie wrote something that really stuck out to our team. Over her 7 years as a school consultant, she said she's witnessed a sharp increase in disruptive behaviors outside of what educators are trained to handle. She wrote that anxiety, depression, self-harm, and suicide attempts are up among children as young as elementary school. She also said she's seen kids destroy school property due to emotional dysregulation, extreme defiance, bullying, and harassment. Her account mirrors what our team has heard from other parents, teachers, and students in our region. So we invited her on the show to talk about the rise in these behavioral challenges and what adults can do to support kids. Annie O'Shaughnessy is the co-founder and co-executive director of the Starling Collaborative based in Underhill Center. They partner with schools to build stronger communities. She's also the coordinator of the Holistic Restorative Education Certificate Program at St. Michael's College in Colchester. Annie, welcome.
Thank you, Michaela. It's wonderful to be here.
We are also joined today by Dr. Mel Hauser. She is a Montpelier-based physician and the executive director of the organization All Brains Belong. It's a nonprofit that's focused on supporting neuroinclusion among children and adults. Dr. Hauser, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Michaela. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you both. And listeners, you can call in as well. Perhaps you're the parent of a student who has either been exhibiting behavioral challenges in school this year or who is feeling frustrated, challenged by seeing those behaviors in other students in the classroom. We might be able to provide some guidance here. Our number is 800-639-2211. Annie, first, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit more about your work with schools. What are those relationships like?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, I'll interject by just saying I am experiencing at the moment the core of what we're going to talk about today, which is my own dysregulation because I'm nervous. So I'm an adult who has skills to manage that. My heart is racing a little bit. My stomach's a little flippy floppy. And I'm lucky because I have the skills and I also have a very strong foundation of relationships in my life. If I did not, I could probably speak some nonsense right now or clam up altogether. I probably wouldn't call you names, but it is a very apt start to this conversation and one that we bring to schools. So we are restorative practices based. But during my time in training schools in restorative practices, I noticed that restorative practices requires the thinking brain, the reasoning brain to be online. And it really doesn't work when our students' brains are not online. So for the listener, that just means there's kind of a cortical shutdown. When there's too much stress, our brains just don't function as they do because they're interested in survival, not in reasoning at that moment. So what we do with schools, and please interrupt me anytime, Michaela, is to help build the conditions in which students and adults can be held accountable. So accountable just means to count. It means your actions count, your good actions count, your not so great choices count. But to be held accountable is by nature extremely dysregulating. And it takes a lot of relational strength and relational, what we call ballast in your boat, to keep you upright when someone calls you out. And what we know, to what we've seen, is that students and adults are less and less able to sit in the discomfort of being held accountable and make that repair that's necessary and to change their behavior because of the impact of the pandemic and other factors that I can talk about later.
Sure. Well, thank you for starting this conversation with a description of how you're feeling. I think that's very helpful to illustrate for listeners what these feelings can feel like in kids as well as adults. Dr. Hauser, this is something that you have studied for many years, both as a doctor and as a parent and as a professional with your nonprofit, All Brains Belong. Could you help us dive a little bit deeper into what is happening in the brain when we talk about dysregulation? I think it's a phrase that people might hear a lot and might not know exactly still what it means.
Absolutely. So I think if before I do that, I'd like to just zoom out a little bit, that I think that the paradigm shift of viewing behavior as a clue to what is going on at the level of the brain, at the level of the nervous system, that is really important. So like, rather than viewing behavioral challenges, disruptions, you know, at like in a vacuum, we should consider them signals that a student's or a teacher's or a parent's or any human's needs are not met. We all have different brains. We all have different needs. And so I think that as a prerequisite to understanding then what is happening at the level of the nervous system. And I think Annie did a lovely job of describing what is happening at the level of the nervous system. You know, I actually really love a model from a book called The Whole Brain Child by Dr. Dan Siegel and Dr. Tina Prain Bryson. They refer to, as Annie talked about, the cortex, that's the thinking part of the brain. They call it upstairs brain. That's the part of the brain that does thinking, planning, decision-making, pausing, impulse control, perspective taking, these higher level functions, the part of the brain that processes information, that learns, right? But downstairs brain or the limbic system, it's a separate part of the brain. These are the, you know, the automatic, you know, so-called fight or flight responses. Their only job is to keep you alive. That's what they do. And so in an overly simplified way, when downstairs brain is triggered for any reason, it could be from sensory processing, it could be the cognitive, the brain demand, the way information in school is presented. It could be a social or communication trigger from a peer or a teacher. It could be simply a memory of a traumatic experience that occurred in that environment. Downstairs brain is triggered, upstairs brain is hijacked and taken offline, like Annie said, and we call that dysregulation, which means that upstairs brain, the thinking part of the brain, is not fully available. And so when upstairs brain is not fully available, we tend to see that logic, reason, in fact, most verbal communication, it just doesn't work. And I think most people of all ages don't necessarily have an awareness of what is happening at the level of the nervous system. And so I think that when we talk about solutions, it really has self-awareness initially, first on the part of the adults, right? If we don't understand our own nervous system, how on earth will we begin to co-regulate nervous system to nervous system with a dysregulated student?
Mm. Well, before we get to some tips, some solutions or ideas to support adults and kids, I want to help our listeners get a better sense of how widespread an issue this is. I think we hear a lot about how behavioral challenges have increased since students returned to the classroom after the pandemic. And if you have a kid in elementary, middle, high school, you might see evidence of that or not. But if you don't, you might just read about this in the headlines or hear about it on a program like ours. It's hard to get actual data on this. Annie, you work directly with schools. What are you seeing?
Yes, I work directly with schools, and I also, in the certificate program, have access to the educator journals that they write about the impact of the practices on their in their context. And so those were just hundreds of anecdotal stories, because I've been teaching this course and doing this work pre and post pandemic, of the incredible increase in behaviors that are well beyond the skills of the teacher or the training of the teacher. And then to validate my anecdotal understanding of this situation, I consulted with a local school psychologist who was brought in to work with the more difficult cases. And she is in many, many states, schools across the state. And I said, you know, how would you quantify what we're experiencing right now. And she said, it used to be that 5% of the kids in a classroom will have trouble with regulation and will tap their pen really hard, will kick their neighbor's chair. This is a way that the nervous system tries to gain balance, by the way. It's an autonomic response to stress, is students kind of maybe punching the chair in front of them, tapping their pen, chomping on their pen, tapping the student next to them. A lot of behaviors that kids get kicked out of school, of class for. She said that those behaviors and worse have been increased double. So if you are a teacher and you have, 30 kids in your class, 10% of your class is going to be causing disruptions that are beyond your kind of scope of working with, because we're not training teachers in what anxiety looks like. We're not training teachers in what we call core regulatory network response to stress, is that tapping and rhythm and movement to try to calm themselves. So that's what we call the rules of the brain, trying to help teachers get caught up on the rules of the brain, because it's so prevalent. But Michaela, I just say that the accounts are so heartbreaking that it's hard to do the work in schools right now if you're privy to some of the heartbreaking situations that are occurring for students in schools, which I know Mel gets a lot of firsthand experience from her clients learning about some of these situations, because no one is really equipped. Not no one, but we're having a hard time handling what we're experiencing.
Dr. Hauser, have you heard of an increase as well in these types of issues?
Unmet access needs have been present for a really long time. Yeah. And when we think about the paradigm, first off, I just want to name, I think being an educator is one of the hardest jobs in the world. And there's not enough resources. And if you think about the idea that nervous systems interact with each other, how on earth would one human be able to, without any training in recognizing early signs of dysregulation before there's any kind of behavioral explosion, how on earth would a human see 30 other people and be able to read their cues, their subtle cues, until the chair is being thrown across the room? So I think that we really need to look at that paradigm too, about the unreasonable expectations on teachers. And I think that, I agree with Annie, many educators have shared with me that they feel really unprepared to recognize those subtle early signs when you have an opportunity to, have access to someone's cortex, to their upstairs brain. If you're too far gone down the train, you really all you can do is co-regulate. And, maybe we need quiet, maybe we need dim lighting, maybe we need no one talking, right? How are you going to do that in a room of 30 people? And so it's really about zooming way out, that schools need to invest in training to help educators understand trauma-informed practices, neurodiversity, just even the way in which an environment is presented in terms of an awareness of sensory processing. We're really talking about 1 in 5 people learns, thinks, and or communicates differently than the so-called typical brain. There isn't really a typical brain, but society most often caters to one particular brain. And that's been the case since the dawn of time. It's really that because nervous systems interact with one another. When I'm stressed, and by the way, if I were in a room with 30 people talking at the same time with fluorescent lights overhead, you better believe I'm going to be dysregulated. And my nervous system puts out energy into the space, that the people in the space with me may become dysregulated because I am dysregulated. So it's just this whole paradigm. First off, I also want to name, we're not through with the pandemic. It's still going. I see more COVID in my medical practice this week than I have in years. So I think that it's not like a pre and post pandemic thing. It's a thing that, there's so much chaos going out there in the world where people don't have their basic needs met. We don't understand one another. We don't have environments that are nurturing and responsive learning environments. So we just have, you know, that's why we're more likely to have incidents of dysregulation.
Mm. If you are a teacher or a retired teacher who has been in this position that our guest, Dr. Milhauser, is describing right now and had to deal with dysregulation yourself or with your students, give us a call. Our number is 800-639-2211. We got an email from a listener named Mike, who said that during today's show, he hoped we would push back a bit against the quote-unquote kids are broken narrative that has dominated since the pandemic. It's rare, he writes, to see coverage that doesn't define our kids and schools in deficit terms. So I'd like to ask, Mike writes, if you were a kid and you heard all the adults saying that your generation has been damaged by the pandemic, devastated by mental health issues, and is years behind grade level, what hope for the future or sense of agency would that leave you with? The problems we face as a society, young people included, did not start with the pandemic. Annie O'Shaughnessy, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this because, while on the one hand, certainly these issues did not appear for the first time with the pandemic, it does sound like they have increased after those difficult years and the after effects of the pandemic. Of course, as you're saying, Dr. Hauser, are still very much a part of our lives. It's still ongoing. People are still getting COVID and dealing with that stress. Annie, what would you say to somebody like Mike?
Well, I really, really appreciate the email. Dr. Hauser was clapping when Michaela read it, because it is time to kind of shift that narrative. And as I was talking to my team about coming online here today, one of them said, please share our student focus group messages to the audience. And one of those messages was from the students, please stop telling us we're so behind. Mm-hmm. Developmentally, academically. And so that brings me to, you know, our thoughts. And our thoughts are, we use this approach called pause, acknowledge, inquire, and restore. And it's called pair up. And it applies to everything. So we're pausing now. We're looking at the impacts of the isolation, of the overexposure to the internet, the stress parenting, the lack of socialization, and where we are. We are naming it, because that's another clear message from students is stop pretending everything is fine. So this is interesting pair of messages we get from students. Stop pretending everything is fine, adults, but stop telling us that we're broken. So thank you, Mike. In that acknowledgement is the basic empowerment of this is where we're at. And then inquiring. Inquiring is the focus of our work is around what Shane Safir and Jamila Dugan call street data. So that book, Street Data, is about the message, please stop trying to fix things before deeply understanding the lives of the people, the decisions and the fix will impact. Please do focus groups with students. Please do focus groups with parents. And so in that book, Shane and Jamila are really trying to disrupt this concept that there's some folks in Montpelier who are responsible for making all the decisions and that, we need this. We need to put this in without the deep understanding of what's happening on the ground, and then engaging those people in the repair, in the restoration and agency. So what can students do? What can adults do? It's this lack of this sensation of hopelessness, helplessness, lack of agency, lack of efficacy that is at the top of the list when it comes to burnout for adults, but also depression, mental health issues for youth. So pause, acknowledge the situation, inquire, talk about it, listen, and then build plans collaboratively to how we're going to face this.
Dr. Hauser, I know you have something to add. We have just a short time before we need to take a break, but go ahead.
Yeah, I really appreciate Annie in linking that lack of agency with the social isolation piece, right? Because we know that lacking social connection, it impacts health just as much as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And so we have to be addressing that piece. So for example, we asked children in our community how we could have kids feel like they belong in community. And a then 9-year-old on our junior advisory board says, let us do what we love. So we started a program where for free, we make customized friend matches for kids based on shared interest, kids age 4 to 17 where we match you with someone who loves what you love. And what we're hearing from kids, teens, families is that they have not before had the experience of being able to show up as their true selves authentically with a peer. And that needs to change. Mm-hmm. And it's not hard to change it. You just have to ask people what they need and try to do it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones here. We have Avi in St. Johnsbury on the line. Avi, go ahead.
Hey there. So I'm an early childhood educator. I work with kids preschool age and younger. And I've been teaching since 2021, so I don't really have the perspective of the before COVID years. But I was hoping to get your guest's thoughts on this work, the dysregulation and co-regulation and working with the brain with children who are preschool age and younger.
Mm. Thank you. Dr. Hauser, let's start with you.
Yeah, so I do trainings for early childhood educators often. And what we find is that the earlier we start entering into this paradigm of recognizing that we all have different brains that do things differently, and we can cultivate self-awareness at the level of the adult, because in a young child, it's still true that we all have different brains that do things differently. And it's just that we are doing more and more co-regulation, and we really have to understand how the sweet little love's brain experiences the world when they often cannot communicate other than through their behavior. So when the earlier someone learns about, hey, how do the brain process its senses? What are the different ways that happens? Or, what does motor planning, putting things in sequence and order, what does that look like? And how do these concepts play out in myself and with my colleagues and with my family members and with my own children? The earlier that can happen, that I think is how you shift the paradigm, because we do have a mainstream society where this is the one lane to go down. Childhood development, even in medical school, I was taught that there was one hierarchical linear way that children develop, and that's just simply not true. There is, in fact, no wrong way to be a person. And yet people from toddlerhood through the rest of their life, they're told over and over that they're wrong, that they're broken. And over time, they just stop trying. So if we can have an early, I love that there's an early childhood educator, thank you so much, who is interested in learning about how the brain works. Because if we can have young preschoolers learn that there are all different ways that brains do things, we're going to have a much more neuro-inclusive world.
Hmm. Annie, I see you also had some tips for early childhood educators as well. Go ahead.
I was really fascinated to, I work a lot with a lot of preschool, pre-K and kindergarten teachers. And when they lost the ability to sing during the pandemic, a bigger loss happened. And that is the brain responds most to regulation through rhythm and patterns and relationship. Those are some of the bigger regulators. And so one of the most stressful times for little ones are points of transition. For anybody, transition times are most. So singing during those times actually had a very, very important role in keeping students regulated as they transition to a new activity. So I found that really fascinating and important.
Oh, how
bring singing back.
Bring singing back. Love that. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Annie. Mm-hmm. Well, from early childhood to middle school. Now let's add one more voice to the conversation here. Patrick Lincoln is the Dean of Students at Hartford Memorial Middle School in White River Junction. It serves about 300 students in grades 6 through 8. And previously, Patrick worked as a mental health counselor for the Hartford School District. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you so much for having me on the show. I've enjoyed listening to the pieces of the conversation I've heard thus far. One of the things I brag about Hartford Middle School is our fantastic performing arts department, and I'll tell our choir, our one of our music teachers, that I'll stop in the hallway, and if I just need a little stress relief, I'll stand outside of her classroom, and she works magic with the kids singing in there, and it's just It's so beautiful and so calming, and I think that the band and her class and the musical they put on actually plays a large role, right, in thinking about discipline and behavior. I think it's nice. It's nice to hear a broader perspective because it is about everything. And the arts play a huge role. So,
and I appreciate that, bringing it back to the very beginning of our conversation when we talked not just about the importance of regulating for kids, but also for yourself as an adult. Patrick, you have a unique role at Hartford Memorial Middle School. You're a dean of students, and you were brought on last January, I believe. What is a dean of students? What's your job?
Well, that's a great question, and a lot of people have that question, right? All kinds of different associations with dean of students. One of the things that attracted me to Hartford schools, because I was working at Dartmouth College in the counseling center there, and then before that, and community mental health and doing public mental health, mostly with kids and families for a long time beforehand. And I was attracted to this district because we have a really robust mental health team, over a dozen folks that have been hired across the district. And really, I'll just say that's a result of our visionary former special ed director, Kim Marino, who hired a clinical director, a clinical psychologist to come on. She sadly lost her very heroic battle with cancer less than a year ago. But she is just an example of some of the most creative, loving, passionate folks that are in this district doing wonderful, wonderful work. And so I came on as a mental health clinician, and the dean of students was, I think, one way to think about it is almost as like clinical director for the school. And I'll also frame it to parents and community around, you know, not just behavior, but really the relationship guy, relationship between students and students, between students and teachers, between teachers and teachers, between teachers and the community. Like, we all have to be in good, solid relationship and repairing when there's rupture. So a lot of my focus is on, you know, preventative work, doing wellness lessons in classrooms, meeting with students sometimes regularly, sometimes in groups. I run a boys group, and then also a lot of the restorative work, right? When there is some kind of harm that's been caused in the building, in what way, that always involves relationships, and in what way do we need to repair those relationships? And that's restorative conversations.
And can you or do you administer detentions or suspensions?
So I have, you know, what you could qualify as or describe as a quasi-administrative role, and so me myself, no. However, we are working towards a community and a school where we can rely less and less on consequences, or like detention, like suspension. But the principal and associate principal, would together, administer those consequences. And I play more of I'm more of a consultant in that regard. And that is something that we use, as little as possible, frankly. And my role would be, if a student is coming back from a suspension, if we've deemed it necessary for someone to take a little break to regroup, my role would be then meeting with parents and that child, maybe with teachers and other children, and how do we learn, how do we make that meaningful, and how do we come back into the school environment?
Patrick, one of the reasons I was really excited to talk to you today was because I read this article recently in the Valley News about a protest that some of the students at your school staged last year. It was actually about other students who they saw as being disruptive in the hallways during class time. And the students who protested this behavior felt like the administration wasn't doing enough to address it, and it was coming in the way of their own learning. I just find that a really fascinating situation, a really nuanced one, and I'm curious how you, in your relatively new role, worked with students and administration and addressed the root causes of that protest.
I appreciate your framing of that question. Definitely fascinating and interesting, and I think one of the most important skills to have as a counselor, as a parent, I've got four kids as well, as a teacher, is developing comfort and the capacity to stay somewhat calm when you don't know what to do. And for me, I'm often asking myself, what's the next right thing? And luckily, I've got lots of amazing people, you know, around me. Like, there's so many wonderful adults who help with answering that question. But what's the next right thing to do? And in this case, you know, we had a group. Yeah, they didn't want to go back to class. They wanted to talk to us. It started with listening and validating, right? A lot of really valid concerns from students about disruptive behavior. You know, behavior that's seen across the country, but it's legitimate to be upset about that. And so taking time to say, hey, we're gonna pause. We're gonna step into the library and we'll take as much time as we need. You know, I'm a big fan of shrinking worlds and slowing down students. Like, we need to slow things down, and we need to, and what by shrinking worlds, I mean just kind of increasing the surface area for connection with other adults, right? So, like, you know, small groups, real long conversations where we're really listening to each other. So we did that, and we talked about also, you know, the reality is everything is also a teaching opportunity. That's what's, you know, ideally schools are, we're this laboratory for, you know, learning that doesn't stop, and also for pluralistic living. Like, we, you know, public schools are kind of an amazing place in that way. Like, we can represent, I think, the best of what we've got going in this country, and, you know, ideally working against, you know, good kids versus bad kids and all the sectarian divisions that bog us down in the rest of the world, right? So we can, how do we move past that and think about learning as a community? And advocacy is great. Activism is great. I've got that in my past for sure. And those skills aren't always the same skills that are needed to build community, right? So it's also talking to those kids about, yeah, this is what it would look like to advocate with the school board. This is what it would look like to go to Montpelier and advocate in that way, or even nationally, right? And just working towards validating, listening, and also steering the conversation towards, hey, we're all in this together. This isn't an us versus them, and that's the kind of adults playing that role. Like, we can't have that dynamic develop in the school. So how do we live into the reality that Dr. Gabor Mate, who's a trauma specialist and written some wonderful books, you know, he has said that safety is not the absence of threat, but the presence of connection, right? So, like, we can get bogged down in eliminating disruption and eliminating discomfort, eliminating distraction. And I get that it's valid, but also how do we lean into building connection, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe in some of those cases, like you mentioned, I mean, in what happened last year, it's conversations between kids who may not be talking to each other. They may be experiencing one another in class, but how do we guide them with some good facilitation to have some heart-to-heart conversation.
And I think many adults in our society could use that as well. Patrick Lincoln, unfortunately, I have to cut you off here because we do need to take one more break. Patrick is the Dean of Students at Hartford Memorial Middle School in White River Junction. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. Yeah, thank you.
Now, before we get back to our guests, we do have some callers who have been waiting patiently on the line that I would like to include in this conversation. Lois in Wallingford, we'll start with you.
Hi. I am so glad that you have this show on today, and your guests are fabulous. This is so needed. I just retired after 40 years in the classroom, and recently, the last 6 years here in Vermont, before I was a classroom music teacher. And I wasn't going to call in until one of your guests mentioned the lack that, because singing wasn't included in changing classes, what a big difference that made during what I refer to as the terrible awful. My last 6 years have been here. Sorry, I've been in Wallingford at Mill River as an assistant, so I've seen all of the changes that have happened during COVID and after COVID. And I guess what I'd like to say is, first of all, meaning teachers, need this kind of training that you're referring to. Teachers are struggling. And that's just, that was the biggest point that I wanted to make, is that it is so difficult. They're, you know, they're dropping like flies, and who can blame them? It's just so, so hard. I was at, by the way, middle school, high school level. And so I am hoping that the type of training that you're referring to here is something that can just happen in every classroom in Vermont, somehow, that our teachers get the training that they need to deal with this new reality. Mm. You know, talking about kids, and I was right there with middle schoolers that, you know, the dysregulation and, you know, you want teachers love kids and they want to help.
Yeah.
But if they don't have the tools to do it, then, you know, their hands are tied.
Thank you so much, Lois, for calling in and for sharing your experiences in the classroom. Let's talk a little bit more about the trainings that are available to teachers. We'll start with you, Dr. Hauser. What types of work are you seeing happening in schools, either through your own organization or others, that listeners might be able to, you know, help their own schools access?
Yeah, so I want to tell you about two different trainings. So more and more schools in Vermont are getting trained in the model called Collaborative and Proactive Solutions, developed by Dr. Ross Green with Lives in the Balance. This is an evidence-based holistic approach that is trauma-informed, relationship-based, and proactive. It's the idea of viewing these breakdowns as, you know, what skills are lagging and how do we prevent these, you know, downstream consequences of behavioral explosion? Because as I said before, you know, you're too far down. You don't now have access to cortex. And it's about really partnering with a child. I've been using this model in my house since my child is 3 years old. And I teach my patients and their families about this model. And I think it really works. And it really supports agency and autonomy and like actually results in co-regulation. Mm. The other thing I'll say is that just like, you know, big picture, this paradigm of learning that we all have different brains and different brains have different needs. The trainings that All Brains Belong offers for a wide range of organizations are really about neuroinclusion, not necessarily something that you do special or extra for, you know, people who have quote special anything. We all have needs. So often we don't know what someone's needs are and they don't know what people's needs are. So neuroinclusion is about offering things in multiple different ways in schools, in workplaces, in healthcare practices, so that you can create environments where people with all types of brains can get their needs met and thrive.
Mm. Thank you for those two suggestions. And Annie O'Shaughnessy, I know you do a lot of this work yourself. What are your thoughts for our listener who called in to say teachers want and need more training on these issues?
Yeah, the first thing I would say is Dr. Bruce Perry has an educator series on PBS, and we actually play some of those videos during our trainings. They're very short. He really distills it down for you, and I think it's kind of essential information. We offer the trauma-informed supports and restorative supports and interventions series to schools across Vermont, and we offer some of those resources online for free at our website. And we hope to, in particular, be offering more to teachers to understand the impact of too much empathizing, to tell you the truth. So there's a whole piece of what our nervous systems and our systems do when we empathize, which means to feel the feelings of other people. When we feel into the feelings of a student who's dysregulated, there is an actual practice there to then disengage so that you can be the solid adult, that you don't get lost in the emotional flooding of that student, because that's a place of subjectivity and it's a place of actual emotional exhaustion to stay there. So there are a couple messages given to teachers that I think can be actually difficult in these times. And that's one of them, is that empathy is a tool to use to activate our compassion. Compassion is action. Now, compassion is actually doing something. So digging into what does it mean to keep a teacher's nervous system online and grounded is something that we are really focused on, because that's like the first line of defense, I would say. But finally, I really want to promote the work of Up for Learning, which is the organization that is about youth and adult partnership. So throughout this entire show, we've been talking about the importance of agency. And I love that it's been framed like that, that it's about what the students are doing together, working together to build a different kind of future than staying with this particular paradigm. Mm-hmm. So if we do not engage the youth, which is what's Up for Learning, is that's their expertise, then we're not moving forward. So between training the teachers in trauma-informed and restorative supports interventions, Ross Green's work, Dr. Bruce Perry's work, we really have a great suite of supports. We just need the time and the resources to get them to teachers.
Thank you for that, Annie. Let's go back to the phones here. We've had Michael waiting on the line. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead. Michael's in Windsor.
Hi, Michaela. Thank you. I was encouraged to hear the comments from the Dean of Students at Hartford Middle School. So thank you to him. I'm retired from there, and so I saw some things that really, really worked well in dealing with students who were having difficulty. I saw it in my colleagues, and often these things were unconventional, but I want to list some of my memories and comments.
Sure.
I think the first thing for me was to be a good listener, just be there, a complete, solid listener to students, my students, students who they dragged in to talk to me, and just listen. And I realized that teachers have this role that's unique. They're not the parent, so the student won't get grounded for talking about their circumstances, their thoughts, their condition. The teacher's not the peer, and so their advice can be trusted maybe more than a peer. And they're not the administration or the counselor. So teachers, if they can just be there as listeners, sit down, pull up a chair, talk to me. I still meet students. They're maybe 40 years old now, but they tell me how important that was.
Michael, I hate to jump in, and I appreciate the irony of jumping in when you were talking about the importance of deep listening. But I so appreciate your points. I just do want to make sure we get back to our guests with just a couple minutes left, because there is one other area that I was hoping to ask both of you about that we addressed a little bit earlier with Patrick from Hartford. And I love that our last caller, Michael, was retired from there. That's great. So for parents of students who maybe do work well in the traditional learning environment of a public school, and those students are feeling frustrated by the fact that there are kids who are dysregulated and that their teachers might not have the resources to focus on them. What's your advice for both kids and parents who are feeling that strain? Dr. Hauser, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think that is really common, and it relates to being stuck in this neuronormative behavioral compliance oriented paradigm that I believe is not helpful. So if kids truly grew up in a paradigm where we recognize that we all have different needs and that those needs will inevitably conflict with other people from time to time. You know, we call that conflicting access needs. If you can teach a preschooler about that, that is gonna have a very different narrative than, oh, you know, that kid is acting out and disrupting me. Because I think the way, Michaela, you just said that is honestly what's happening, but that's not what the observer often has as a narrative. It's like that bad kid, because that's what's been modeled for them their whole lives through their education to date. So I think that model of conflicting access needs, and that when both parties have access to their cortex, that is when we engage in some of the practices that Annie and Patrick have been talking about community coming together, relationships. How do we negotiate and navigate conflicting access needs? Like in my house, my now 7-year-old has an access need to make a lot of noise and discharge their energy, while I have an access need for complete and utter quiet at all times. It doesn't mean that either one of us is wrong. It's just that we have conflicting access needs, and we have to figure that out together when we both have access to our cortex.
I feel that one deeply. And Annie O'Shaughnessy.
Thank you, Dr. Hauser. It's so nice to be a co-guest with you. Our minds are very similar. In terms of real in the classroom practices, I think it's really important to name that trauma happens when we, one of the factors that we can't make sense of what is happening. We cannot make sense of it. So what the school psychologist shared with me once was that she had teachers practice a post classroom, sometimes when a student is so dysregulated, the classroom is evacuated and the student is left there to calm down. So when everyone comes back into the community, what is the teacher going to say about what just happened? Okay, so she offers a script on how to de-shame that, how to help them understand it, so those rest of those students are not feeling traumatized, confused. On the other end of that is what we do, which is to set up the classroom every year at the beginning with agreements about what are we going to do when one of us are in our downstairs brain? Mm. What will that look like? What does it look like for you when you're in downstairs brain? What should we do? What support should we give? So you get the idea that there's actual structures and systems and practices that we put in place to help kids make sense of this and actually support each other. So I could talk all day about this one because I have a lot of teachers in the field, third grade, all the way up, who do this work and do it successfully and see a huge decrease in the number of evacuations in classrooms. Mm.
Well, that's great to hear. And I'm glad we can end on this note as well, because I think this conversation can often be very dispiriting, as one of our earlier email writers told us. But you two have given me hope that there are lots of tools out there that kids, adults, teachers, administrators can all use. Dr. Mel Hauser is a physician in Montpelier. She's with All Brains Belong. Dr. Hauser, thank you so much. It's a joy having you on.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Annie O'Shaughnessy is the co-founder and co-executive director of the Starling Collaborative. Annie, thank you. And thank you for this idea for this show that you maybe unwittingly set off for us.
Oh, thank you so much, Mikhail. I can't tell you how heartening it is to have that responded to and to be here with you and Mel. Thank you. And to Patrick, thank you so much.
Well, before we wrap today, I want to read one more email that we got from a listener named Benjamin in Barry right before the show started. Barry writes, I'm a 37-year-old Vermonter and had significant behavioral issues in my adolescent years, especially compared to my peers. I was never violent, just very angry. A therapist once told me I had reservoirs of anger. I believe that anger masked other emotions, or even more specifically, protected hurt. It was easier to rebel than it was to understand why and how I felt. I focused my defiance on one teacher in particular. Did I see her as a safe recipient? Maybe I trusted her. I found most of my tools and support being at my friends, peers, sports, and self-medicating. I wanted space, trust, and empathy. I wanted to be held accountable for my behavior and space to process my choices. It wasn't until late in life that I explored these things. I did so with a therapist, and I suggest to students to hang in there. Things will get better. And to people supporting behavioral issues in kids, to hold them accountable as well as give them space and show them empathy. Benjamin and Barry, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your experience with us today.